funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We've talked endlessly about what the economic crisis is doing to us as a nation, so what might it do for us? Is it worth trading the ethos of brash exuberance and instant gratification we have cultivated since the 1980s for a new kind of pragmatism and pride in our own stewardship of the planet, of our creative potential, and of each other? Writer and Studio 360 host Kurt Anderson explores the benefits of our amended future outlook in a new book called Reset, How This Crisis Can Restore Our Values and Renew America. And we are excited to have him here to talk about it. Kurt, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
You start this essentially by reminding us that we really should have seen this coming, or that, in fact, we did see it coming but chose not to pay attention.
I think that's true for a lot of us, not everybody, but there were many signs along the way. There were the kind of economic metric signs, as our average household savings rate fell from around 14% or 15% at the beginning of the 1980s to just about zero as of 2007, you know, as the financial industry, the bankers and Wall Street people of the world went from, and during the same period, having about 15%, 16% of all of the economy, of the GDP, to about 40%. So there were those signs. But then I think I look at other signs. I look at how fat we've gotten
literally
since fat. I mean, we were fat and happy in all senses, figuratively and literally, and we were living large in all senses and have been. No, I mean, the average American today of a given age is 20 pounds heavier than he was or she was in 1980. That's a lot of lack of discipline and self-indulgence. And again, I don't want to be a hectoring America about your bad, naughty habits, but I think it was all of a piece that it, you know, and frankly, it started even earlier. I mean, you know, I'm a member of the baby boomer generation, and we came of age saying, if it feels good, do it. Well, I think that kind of came home to roost in a little bit in many ways, or especially over the last 10, 20 years. Thinking that there was no piper to pay, that we could have it all, that we could eat it all, that we could have the biggest house we want, and maybe it doesn't look like we can afford it, but somehow we will, because we'll clap our hands and believe. You know, as a country, we go through these periods, and it's part of who we are, and then at a certain point we kind of it comes crashing down around our ears, and we sober up and fly right.
You know, one thing that's really interesting to me, Kurt, about the savings rate, which has been sort of alternately lamented and dismissed over the past 15 years or so, that it's really dropped to almost nothing. For a while, people were saying, well, no one's saving because they're saving their money in the stock market, which turned out not to be such a good idea.
Well, there you go. I mean, and the idea that there was, you know, that all this risky behavior and risky taking risks, as we know, is great. It's part of what makes America great. But we convinced ourselves that we could take risks, but they weren't really risky. That the stock market couldn't really go down. That our houses would always increase in value. And so we try to have it both ways, you know, in this risk taking society. We all like to talk about, oh, this is a risk taking society. Yeah, but the whole idea of taking risks is that sometimes the bet doesn't work out. But we sort of pretended as though that wasn't going to happen and couldn't happen.
Well, and we almost started feeling, I guess, invincible in that even if, you know, if the stock market wasn't going well, value was still sort of exploding in the real estate that we might own. Or if we weren't working, we were still doing well in the stock market. There was always some kind of protection. So we didn't really believe that risk had a penalty to it.
Well, and there is this history of what is called American exceptionalism, that we are somehow different than anyone else. And we are, in so many great ways, different than everybody else. But we are not free of the basic economic rules. It's like saying we're free of gravity. No. Gravity will reassert itself eventually. I think that the amazing and wonderful end of the Cold War for which the United States can, you know, claim a large part of that achievement sort of reinforced this sense of, oh, it's a magical new world, and we're just winners, and so let's keep on winning, without really looking at along the way the potential, the pitfalls, and how things could come undone and unraveled, and then they did.
So we've talked a little bit about American exceptionalism and that tendency that we have to take these big risks. We hate to wait for things. We believe that our ship is just about to come in. On the balancing side of that, throughout our history, has been this extraordinary tolerance that we have for really hard work. It seems funny that those two things don't ultimately temper each other when things are going very, very well.
Yeah, it is. We're kind of a bipolar people. We have both of those things to an extreme degree, this kind of practical, hardworking, slow-building ingenuity, all the values that we imagine our founders had or that the greatest generation had and all those. And that's real. But we also have inside us, to various degrees on an individual basis, but in a kind of, I would say, a more or less equal basis as a national character, this swing for the fences, you know, wildcatter, speculative, slightly wild and crazy side that I love and is is part of what makes America, and certainly makes Texas and makes us all different than Canada, say, but. But they instead of coming to some sort of steady equilibrium, as you're suggesting, it tends to be a kind of constant pendulum swing in our economic and political history.
Recognizing that history does not repeat itself, and you have a wonderful quote in the book from Mark Twain, what can we learn by looking at past Gilded Ages and the way they all ultimately ended?
Well, and the quote from Twain is great because he says it doesn't repeat history, but it rhymes. And I think that's a very useful way of thinking about it, because it's not, you know, oh, this is not 1932. This is not 1932. It's not going to be exactly the same. We're not going to have a New Deal. It wasn't the Depression. But there are enough similarities that it's worth looking at all these panics and bubbles that we've been through again and again and again. The first Gilded Age, the original Gilded Age, which lasted for about 20 years near the end of the 19th century, was nicely bookended by two panics and collapses that started with runs on banks. And, you know, what came shortly thereafter was the Progressive Era, where we decided, you know, maybe we should have some regulation about how our meat is packed and how our food and water is treated and processed and so forth. So and you know, and before long we said maybe we should have a little income tax. Wouldn't be such a bad idea. So there are that was the great swing toward this public-spirited era. And of course none of these eras last forever. We had the Roaring Twenties. So there is part of us, part of America, that likes gildedness and living large and lavish living and getting and spending, and what's wrong with that? And what is wrong with that, except we sometimes get a little bit out of control. And this last era compared to all the historical ones that I know about lasted exceptionally long. I mean, really, if you say this last boom era began with the beginning of the long bull market on Wall Street in 1982 and ended last fall, let's say, that's a 26-year era. Usually these eras last, well, the Roaring Twenties, for instance, lasted less than a decade. And that's roughly what these periods last, is a decade, 8, 10, 12, 15 years. So we had a very long period, and among other things, as a result, we have a generation or two of people who've never lived in another era, which is why one of the reasons, as I sort of describe in the book, this is, you know, it's both an opportunity to sort of rethink and have a wake-up call for lots of people out of the, you know, to some degree, the sort of magical, charmed life we've been leading. But it's also – it makes it more difficult because there's no – for anybody under 30, certainly there's no before to know about firsthand. Everybody put everything on credit cards and damn the expense.
So what do you think about this? Because you're a baby boomer. I'm a Gen Xer. We both have either parents or grandparents who lived through the Great Depression, and we know that that generation was certainly, for the rest of their lives, largely affected by that experience and lived in a way that is much more prudent than the boomers or the Gen Xers are now, that the millennials are living. What kept them from translating those lessons to us in a way that was strong enough that we wouldn't make the mistakes that we have?
That's a very good question. And I remember growing up in Omaha, Nebraska, the child of Depression people, my parents, that is, and being so annoyed that they, you know, there were three potato chips left in the bag and they would keep it and put a little paper clip on it. And I felt like, get over it. You know, the Depression's long since over. You know, I think they did, in my case, transmit some of their frugality to me, and I'm a little cheap as a result, and I am a little prudent. So I think, you know, here and there we have had the direct kind of, you know, oral history transmission of those parts of the American character to later generations. But, you know, one of the things that started with the baby boomers was this sense that, oh, we're different than anyone else has ever been. We are better, newer, cooler. The old rules don't apply. Let's party. And I think one of the legacies of that is that all the subsequent generations so far, yours, for instance, kind of has adopted the same idea that this that now is this perpetually new moment where the old rules don't apply, you know, and that's why they call it corrections in the stock market. You get corrected and you get whacked upside the head when you think you can, you know, get away with partying too long and spending money you don't really have and have no reasonable hope of getting. But it is, you know, it is interesting given the idea of the greatest generation, this Depression World War II generation becoming this huge idea in America. Boy, those people were frugal. They fought a war. They were heroic in their quiet way. But it's funny that that came to be an idea during the most lavish, wild, and crazy part of this recent era, because it was like, oh, that's how people used to be. Well, no, that's part of who we are, I think, as Americans, and it's not just a matter of celebrating how our parents and grandparents' generation. It is. Truly, there are useful habits and useful models of how they live their lives that I think it's time for us to look at and apply.
Well, I wonder, and taking absolutely nothing away from the greatest generation, if we haven't so lionized them that we've convinced ourselves as boomers and Gen Xers that we couldn't possibly do that if we tried, that we couldn't be that strong.
Well, that's an interesting point. And you know, we have had some, you know, unpleasant wars, and 58,000 Americans died in Vietnam, and you know, more than 4,000 have died in Iraq. So we've had the experience of war, but nothing like World War II. So in addition to this, the Great Depression, which was so much more wrenching and terrifying and game changing than this terrible recession we are still in, there was this war as well. So there is this sort of super heroic quality to what they went through, but you know, they were people, and they were our parents and grandparents, and they were Americans like us.
Kurt Anderson is my guest. He is the host of PRI's Studio 360 and a writer. His new book is called Reset: How This Crisis Can Restore Our Values and Renew America. You can join us right now by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is a writer and host of PRI's Studio 360. His new book is called Reset: How This Crisis Can Restore Our Values and Renew America. If you'd like to join the conversation, send an email to think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372. Kurt, you call for a sort of 12-step approach. What could be more American than this to getting a handle on the way that our culture has declined? At its core, of course, is admitting that we've got a problem. Is that happening, do you think, though, on a personal, individual level yet? Or are we still at a place where we realize that everyone else was living to excess, but we were sort of okay?
Well, that's a good point, that everybody else was the addict and the abuser and not us. I think it's happening. I know in my own life it's happening. It happened very quickly sort of trying to get that difference between what you want and what you need more in line. And I think as we mentioned, talked about before, the fact that people are saving more is part of that. The thing, the comparing it to addiction and recovery, which I've actually talked to some recovered addict friends of mine before I wrote this, and thought they said, you got that pretty much right. The difference between being addicted to alcohol or drugs and the situation we're in as individuals and as a country is that we can't stop, we can't go cold turkey and quit spending or quit in most cases. Assuming credit and borrowing money. So it's a question of abstinence. And, I think, again, as we've talked about, Americans tend to sort of swing wildly. It's all this or it's all that. It's either we're drunks or we're recovered. Whereas, as economic beings, what we have to do is be temperate and be moderate. And that doesn't come quite as easily, but that's absolutely what's required. And I do think, I don't take pleasure in these numbers that come out about how poorly companies like Abercrombie and Fitch and other retailers are doing. But I have to say, I take it as, maybe when I hear that a company that sells, frankly, inessential things to my children, isn't doing so well, I think, maybe people are taking the punching the reset button and thinking like, I don't need a fourth, shirt that will make me the envy of my peers in high school. Maybe just three will do. So yeah, I have a sense that people are. Now again, it's not as though we changed from Martians to Venusians overnight. It's not ever a matter of this kind of instant 180-degree change. But I do have a sense in the conversations I have with people, in my own life, in those kinds of numbers I look at, that people are beginning to look at their lifestyles in a different way.
It does seem, though, that there's been sort of a relief expressed by certain people that they've wanted to jump off that bandwagon of having a T-shirt in every color, but they couldn't do it until the people next door and the kids down the street were doing the same thing.
I think you're absolutely right. I as I was talking to people, as I was writing the essay that became this book and then writing the book, I heard that again and again. There was this sense that this kind of compulsive behavior, compulsive spending, and getting the newest this and the bigger that, and this laptop that's a little bit more powerful than the one I have because my pal got that and he says it's great. I think jumping off that sense that there's no choice but to spend more and buy bigger is good. Again, I'm not saying we should all become ascetics or monks or live in little cottages in the woods or anything of the sort. But, we're talking about relatively, those of us who are lucky enough to have jobs and incomes, relatively small changes in the aggregate can be huge, in terms of what is sustainable. I mean, the idea of sustainability has become captured by the environmental movement, and that's fine. But sustainability to me, and I talk about this in the book, is a much bigger thing, and it's not just a liberal thing. It's the to me, my late parents were the great kind of Republicans who were all about sustainability, both in an environmental sense, but in the can you afford this? Can you afford this over time? That kind of green eye shade sustainability, I think, has to be part of what we adopt going forward, as well as the what goes under the rubric of sustainability more often about, you know, using funny light bulbs and fuel efficient cars.
Kurt Anderson is my guest. His new book is called Reset: How This Crisis Can Restore Our Values and Renew America. We'll go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372 and speak first with James in Dallas. Hello, James.
Hi. I just had a thought that, you know, the boomers and the Xers who came of age in times of prosperity might have different... you know, they might be differently culturally formed than, say, the Greatest Generation or Generation Y, who both came of age in time of economic hardship and war. And I will take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call. What do you think about that, Kurt?
I think it's an interesting point. I think I look at my children who are, you know, just barely on the verge of adulthood, and the fact that their coming of age period really has been bracketed by, you know, when they were little kids by 9/11, and now that they're young women by this crack up and meltdown. I think that is a very different kind of generational creation myth than I had, certainly, coming of age, you know, being as old as they are now in the early 70s. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I also think as a result of not just as the caller mentioned, the prosperity versus this, you know, kind of recessionary era as a culturally formative moment. Again, extrapolating from my kids, their friends, what I read, I actually think this, call it Generation Y or Millennials, whatever, actually begins to have generationally distinct character from Gen Xers and baby boomers in terms of really, for instance, walking the walk in terms of relative racial color blindness, as well as talking the talk, that kind of tolerance, and it's no big deal. I think what I see as this kind of natural urge, or kind of the degree to which they prized consensus in deciding, you know, where five of them are going to go to, you know, have a drink, or what a nation should do, or their college, or their school, or whatever. I think that's real. And so it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. To me, you know, I think the boomers certainly have a lot to answer for in getting us to the mess we're in. And I frankly am, I don't know if my kids' generation is going to be the next greatest generation, but I think they're getting off to a pretty hopeful start. And as I see them applying in these extraordinary numbers, for instance, to things like Teach for America, and that sense of really wanting to be to help the community, to be part of a community, to do right by the world, I think that's a very hopeful sign.
Yeah, you write about in the book this idea that we can finally maybe decouple the concept of wealth from happiness and understand that they may or may not have anything to do with each other. I wonder if part of that comes from the fact that these millennials were sort of raised having everything they wanted and recognized that it didn't necessarily have an impact on how they felt about themselves or about the rest of the world.
That's a very interesting point. And I think in all the ways they're kind of wised up early, and they understand when they're being marketed to, and they understand all that stuff that, you know, I think earlier generations of kids sort of had to discover and be disillusioned about on their own. I think that's true. I think they it is part of the, you know, certainly contemporary American idea that wealth indeed equals happiness in a straight line. I think not only does the research, the psychological research, say that after a certain point of having what you need and having a certain amount of relatively modest amount of money, that line levels off, and the extra $10,000 a year doesn't give you what it did back when you were you know, earning a lot less. I think that's a great point, that kids sort of get that. Yeah, sure, they want, you know, they want an iPhone, they want, you know, the new Nintendo platform or whatever it is they want. But I think they see in a way clearly about how after above and beyond a certain point, money really, you know, the extra unit of happiness that money buys is very pricey at the higher end.
Maybe they'll just represent a generation that is better at occupying the sort of middle ground where the truth exists. Because, you know, I think for previous generations, we have maybe assumed that money equaled happiness because we know that poverty very often equals unhappiness. Mm-hmm. And maybe this generation sort of understands that just because one thing is true doesn't mean its opposite is also true.
Excellent point once again. And one hopes that sense of kind of instinctive reasonableness and moderation can come to the fore increasingly with this generation and maybe even for the rest of us who are older to imagine exactly so much. As I've been discussing this book the last week, so often, you know, when callers call in on radio stations, it's either one thing or the other. We're either becoming a socialist, you know, Soviet American republic, or you know, the absolute free market must prevail. Well, of course, it's neither one thing or another. And again, my sense of younger people and people my kids' age is that kind of tendency to extremism really isn't much part of their kind of generational DNA. That there's a kind of the kind of upside, if you will, of the oh whatever. Is a reasonableness that, like, I'm not going to get too, you know, I'm not going to allow my buttons to be pushed by either the Keith Olbermans of the world or the Rush Limbaughs of the world to believe, you know, to go to the fringes. And this kind of moderate reasonableness it seems to be part of the political zeitgeist that I think younger people are embodying.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking to Kurt Anderson about his new book, Reset, How This Crisis Can Restore Our Values and Renew America. Let's go next to Ben in Dallas. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Chris. Great show as always. Here's a little something I wanted to add to this discussion, okay? And I'll get my response off the air. Actually, I've seen a couple of things about this on some online forums. Apparently, the argument that I'm bringing up is this. Apparently, if all the services are done by companies that provide them, all the products are made, all the efficiency in the system is achieved, we are going to end up still with a chronic unemployment of slightly above what we have even today. I mean, Europeans, Germany, France, Central Europe have learned to live with chronic unemployment since the 80s, and they have come up with a public support system, a welfare state, if regime, if you will, to support that. And for example, if all the shoes were made, all the services were provided, there would still be a number of us that couldn't find jobs. Why? Because we are learning to be more frugal. So apparently, Chris, the difference that is made if we want to go to unemployment below 8 or 9% or 5% or 6%, that little bit of extravagance, if you will, buying the second iPod and buying the third car and going to movies three times a month instead of once, apparently that's what our economy needs to stay in the nice and cushy zone, if you will. And if we all go ahead with some of these very reasonable recommendations that or ways that we have developed in the past 2 years, personally, I'm talking, you know, being a little more frugal, and it's a great thing on personal level, but it looks like the economy, at least in this country, if it's going to go under 10 or 8 or 7% of unemployment, we do need that little bit of extravagance in the cultural looseness, if you will, in spending.
And what do you think about that, Kurt?
That's a very interesting comment, and certainly a plausible scenario. I think certainly in the last year we should have all learned not to trust economic forecasts to be anything close to a bankable version of the future, and I think we'll find out if that's true. If we have become so – the economy has become so dependent on this, you know, constant – this kind of manic level of consumption that we've seen that without that we'll have higher unemployment. I know there are economists who disagree with that forecast, you know, and I also think that, you know, to that point, I mean, a good chunk of what we're spending – on our flat TVs and our laptops and so much of the rest of our kind of galloping consumption, sure, there are some American jobs created, but there are an awful lot of that money is going into the bank accounts of Chinese people, frankly. And so I think we'll see how it works out. But, you know, this is a relatively the level of consumption and the level of leveraged credit-based consumption that we've had for the last 10 or 20 years is a new thing. I mean, this isn't the way it has always been. So I'm hopeful that looking a little further back in history can lead us to can show us versions of that balance between saving and spending and the rest of it that were sustainable. With relatively low rates of unemployment until the 1970s.
We're talking this hour to Kurt Anderson, who is a writer and also host of PRI's Studio 360. His new book is called Reset: How This Crisis Can Restore Our Values and Renew America. You can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in September. You can learn something new. Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Kurt Anderson. He is a writer and host of PRI's Studio 360. He's got a new book out called Reset: How This Crisis Can Restore Our Values and Renew America. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. Kurt, to Ben's point in the last segment about the need to sort of overconsume in order to stimulate the economy, it would seem to me that the one thing that we can sustainably consume almost to an unlimited degree is content. And that's the one thing that in this economy we have not really been able to figure out how to keep monetized.
Well, that's right. And what's changed in terms of media content is, of course, there is now not only can we consume it in an unlimited amount, but it can be created in an unlimited amount thanks to the new technologies. And no, we are definitely in a long transitional moment when it comes to how people who create journalism especially, but also music and television, are to be compensated going forward. And the old systems, whether the newspapers and news magazines or the old record label model or even the more slowly shriveling television network model, obviously they are all dead industries walking, and so that has yet to be figured out, and it's interesting that's been going on for a while. I think this last year, as it has pushed certainly newspapers directly to and over the brink, has served to make journalists covering the economic meltdown especially acutely, unusually aware of the sky is falling quality of the moment.
Do you think that's made the coverage a little bit too terrified?
I had that thought during the depths of the terror last fall and winter. It struck me back 10 years ago. I wrote about how because journalists and people on Wall Street were the most committed early adopters of the internet and digital technology because they could use it in their respective jobs. And so they kind of created the digital bubble because, hey, they're using it and it's essential to what they do. I think we're now seeing the other end of that or certainly saw it last winter at the beginning of the depths of the crisis that the Wall Street people took the first big hits and the media people were as well. So I think they both made the digital bubble happen a little bit and inflated it on that end, and then as the larger economy was having its crisis moment lately, I think their hysteria did become a little bit self-fulfilling.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with Tim in Dallas. Hey, Tim.
Hey there. Great show, and just so topical, as always. I had a comment that I'm going to bring up, but I just wanted to kind of give my own opinion on what the caller that talked about the idea of increasing extravagance in order to kind of save us, if you will. It strikes me very similar to George Bush's comment after we were attacked on 9/11 that what we needed to do in order to thwart terrorism and restore our values was to go to the malls. The idea of increasing extravagance, spending more money in order to lower the idea of unemployment might make sense just from a pure ideological standpoint. However, I think most numbers will show us that as our extravagance increases, so too does our credit card debt, and more importantly, so too does the unpaid credit card debt that is out there. So, yes, it may, in fact, give us on the short term an increase in the number of jobs that are out there because of manufacturing, et cetera, but in the long term, it very well may put us right back in the situation that we found ourselves in and still are in now because of the massive amount of debt that cannot be sustained in and of itself. So that's just my opinion about that. But the real reason that I called was with the idea of sustainability from our own household standpoint. You know, one of the ways that my wife and I have made a transition over the last maybe 6 months as a result of all this going on is that we are making the conscious effort not to necessarily compare ourselves to our neighbors or our coworkers or our relatives in terms of what they have and how we need to compare to that and live up to it. We've made a concerted effort to look at how we are compared to the average world citizen. Depending on where you look at on the web or listen to, the average world citizen lives on anywhere from $2 to $6 a day, and we are upper middle class wage earners in this country. So in their eyes, we're billionaires, and that makes it very difficult for us to validate continuing purchases of things that aren't necessary in our lives. And the other way that we kind of do it is that we've really, really embraced the idea of want versus need. And even though it's very difficult to do sometimes, we have found that, in essence, what we really feel like that we need, it really just boils down to an emotional attachment to a want that goes right back to this idea of comparing to other people that are closer to us and how we need to, kind of keep up with them.
Really quickly.
So I just wanted to make that point.
Yeah, really quickly, Tim, because I want Kurt to have a chance to respond to all of that. Has it gotten easier to over 6 months of thinking about want versus need? Does it get easier as time goes by?
Absolutely. I can't tell you how much easier it is now. And it's in the beginning, it was so, so difficult because, again, really what it boiled down for us was is that it's just habit.
Yeah,
it's just emotional habit is all it is. And so just like with children, I mean, with our kids, that was the hardest part, too. But now they're changed as well, because a reality is only what it is when you're in it. And the longer you're in it, the more, day to day, it just becomes part of what your existence is.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your call.
It's my pleasure.
What do you think, Kurt?
I want to take Tim with me on the rest of my book tour. He is the reset person. I got goosebumps listening to him, frankly. Mm-hmm. And I think it's exactly right. I mean, again, it's not easy, but I think people find, like Tim, that once you really you sort of get out of the reverie, the fever dream of sort of acquisition and consumption, you know, it's not such a fall off. And again, we're talking. I mean, it sounds like he has a good job and has a good income coming in, and so you know, there are, we don't want to, you know, diminish the pain of those people who are really have been hurt badly by this. But I think for most of us, and most of us, you know, 90% of us who want jobs have them. It's not such a wrenching. We're not talking about, as I say, you know, becoming hair shirt wearing monks. We're talking about ratcheting it back a little bit.
Let's go back to the phones, and this time we'll speak with Scott in Fort Worth. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Chris. Hey, Kurt. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Great show. Kurt, my question is, you touched on this just a little bit earlier. Is the future of traditional politics. I'm 34, and I think most people, you know, my feeling is that most people about my age and younger, we don't really feel like we fall into the traditional political categories and the traditional party. How do you see this next generation resetting politics going forward? We saw a great deal of consensus in the last election, and I think we're already starting to see that fragment. So I'd like to hear your comments on where you see this going, in the next 10 years.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm with you on feeling as though certainly the two-party system as we have it in the United States is kind of ossified and sclerotic and doesn't really conform to the real world of Americans' ideas about what should be done. I have been one of my hobby horses that I've been on for some time is the wish, and it may be more wishful than real in terms of projecting the next 10 years, for a third party that was meaningful, that, you know, essentially in the simplest form, you cut off the 25% on the right, you cut off the 25% on the left, and that 50% in the middle of reasonable people who aren't prone to extremes and really just want to make things work better, that becomes your new party. Depending on the two parties, talking about entrenched institutions that are resistant to a reset are really entrenched institutions. And as we see in both parties, I think people who are at the farther edge of left or right tend to become the people who run those parties. I do think that I'm hopeful about people, you know, of younger people sort of rejecting the traditional left-right Democrat-Republican, talking point programs. And I do think that one of the reasons, you know, that put the Democrats and Obama over last fall was the sense that for the moment anyway, the Democratic Party had a bigger tent and less dominated by its wingnut faction than the other party. If it loses that big tent and it's more kind of autopilot sort of ultra-liberal constituency seems to have taken it over, that will be a political problem. And I think people like the caller would rightly reject that. But I'm hopeful that the about its leader, our president, in kind of keeping to some place in the the left side of the middle of the road, but still the middle of the road.
We haven't really touched on this at all in this hour, but I do think it's a really interesting element of the book, and that's that you call for a rekindling of the sort of amateur spirit in this country. Can you define what that means and what sort of difference it might make moving forward?
Well, I talk about how really this country, almost uniquely among large countries, certainly, was invented by amateurs, people who were amateur politicians like Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson. And that really has been in business as well as politics has been a kind of animating part of who we are. I mean, the idea of a democracy is, after all, government by amateurs, not by professional politicians. People like the Wright brothers, Steve Jobs. I mean, the great American Inventors Hall of Fame and Entrepreneurial Hall of Fame is all about that amateur spirit, which is to say, doing things for the sheer crazy love of it, rather than to just earn a living. I mean, so I'm not saying that we've had an unfortunate decoupling of the idea of the amateur spirit and the way you earn a living in professional life. They don't need to be. I mean, you know, not to toot our own horns at public radio so much, but public radio is a great example of...
It's full of amateurs.
It's full of amateurs. But you see, we laugh because amateur has become this pejorative. The amateur spirit is this beautiful, great thing. I mean, the Latin root is lover. I mean, people who love to do this thing. And that sense of, hey, we can do it. We can put on a show. And yes, there are some professionals here at public radio who go on the air and operate the boards and all the rest. But why public radio is able to exist is – and I sound like I'm going into a fundraising spiel, but why it's able to exist is all of these people inside and outside the stations who have this great – desire to make this thing happen, even though they didn't start out, 10 years, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 35 years ago when public radio was really getting going with any credential to do what they're doing. I see it in the digital explosion of the last dozen years. The people making new web apps, crazy new sites, blogs, videos, pieces of music. This digital revolution really has been enabled by this and has further enabled this sort of renaissance of this amateur spirit. Some of whom end up making a living. Some of whom end up making a fortune. But it's animated by the desire to do something cool and do something new and to create something new, not by, oh, yeah, it's a decent way to, earn a living. And that... finding, the things that are interesting to do and then sort of going all out to try to do them, that is the amateur spirit I'm talking about.
Well, and it brings you back to the original point, which is that it's much easier to take those sorts of creative risks if you need to make a living but not necessarily a fortune. If you head into work expecting to be rich, there are a lot of careers that won't work.
Well, I am now old enough that I have seen the choices that friends of mine made at 22 and 26 about, like, you idiot, you're trying to be a writer. I'm doing this thing that's easy money, and I'm going to be a lot richer than you. And, some of them are a lot richer than I am. However, it has not made them happier. I think when people get to a certain age, as well as coming naturally to young people, when people get to a certain age, you see that the sustaining thing is the passion for what you do, not the tremendous salary you're being paid to do something.
Kurt Anderson is a writer, and he's host of PRI's Studio 360. His new book is called Reset: How This Crisis Can Restore Our Values and Renew America. Kurt, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Total pleasure for me. Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.